The following interview was conducted by Max Borders, managing editor of TCS Daily. For more information, please visit our website at tcsdaily.com.
Joining us is Jeffrey Frieden, Stanfield Professor of International Peace at Harvard University. Professor Frieden specializes in the politics of international financial relations and is author of numerous books on the subject. He's just released a book called Global Capitalism, Its Fall and Rise in the 20th Century, which will be the topic of today's discussion. Welcome, Professor Frieden.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
What you've written here is a kind of history of global capitalism in the 20th century. Aside from satisfying history buffs, why is a book like this important for understanding where the world is headed in terms of global trade?
Well, I think the principal thing to take away from it for today's world is that, in some sense, we've been here before. People look at the international economy today, at global capitalism today, at the extraordinary integration of financial markets, goods markets, of immigration around the world, at the way in which the world has been tied together economically, and tend to think that this is something totally new. But it's not. 100 years ago, the world was roughly as tied together economically as it is today. Goods traveled freely around the world. Finance traveled freely around the world. People traveled far more freely around the world 100 years ago than they did today. Immigration to most countries was more or less free. You could come to the United States effectively without papers. So the world has been economically integrated before. Globalization, if you will, to use the current buzzword, is not a new thing. In fact, it characterized the organization of the world economy for generations before 1914. It was the generally accepted, generally anticipated order of things for many, many decades, and it collapsed. So a question for us is there something about the organization of contemporary global capitalism that might make it vulnerable to the same kinds of problems and issues that arose during and after 1914. So I guess I would say that the first and foremost source of interest in the historical experience of global capitalism is that the contemporary organization of the world economy is very reminiscent of the organization of the world economy 100, 120 or so years ago. And although there were a number of very important and very positive effects of that organization, ultimately it didn't last that long, certainly didn't last forever. And we'd like to understand why the globalized world economy of the decades before 1914 did, in fact, fail, and how and under what conditions it was put back together.
That's actually a good segue into the next question. You open Chapter 3 of your book with a lovely passage written by an observer at the 1900 World's Fair in Paris, which seems to draw a picture of globalization on display. Apart from Javanese palaces, the straw huts of Senegal, and the castles of the Carpathians, forming an astounding international medley beneath a gray Lenten sky, what else would visitors to that World's Fair have seen?
I think the thing that would have impressed visitors to the World's Fair, although obviously not us, of course, is the extraordinary technological advances. That was where electricity in its most powerful form was first put on massive display for many people. Electricity, of course, had existed before, but here it was used to run everything from an escalator, I believe the first escalator, to the new Paris subway system, to a display of artificial lightning, to microscopes, all sorts of ways in which electricity, which was very new at the time, was put on display. A second thing that would have impressed most visitors, and I think we know from eyewitness accounts, did impress most visitors, was that the traditional homelands of industrial capitalism, of the Industrial Revolution, that is, Great Britain, France, and Belgium, were quickly being surpassed, and in fact had been surpassed, by new economic and industrial powers like Germany and the United States. And perhaps even more striking was the fact that a country, a very far away, exotic country that most people knew of as a land of silken kimonos and Mikado, and the Mikado was now an industrial power. In 1900, Japan had undergone what at that point, to that point, had been probably the most rapid industrial development of any country in the world, and Europeans were stunned by the fact that Japan was now an industrial power. They would be even more stunned a few years later when the Japanese Navy defeated the Russian Navy during the Russo-Japanese War. So I think the spread of industrial industrialization away from its homeland in the United Kingdom, France, and Belgium was startling. Its spread as far afield as to Japan was also startling. The overtaking, as the British called it, of Britain by Germany, the U.S., and other countries. And then also the extraordinary technological advances of the era.
Now, you know, the 20th century is so rich with events, it's hard for me to say let's fast forward a little, but we get this great war behind us in World War One. Describe, if you can, in broad strokes, the Roaring Twenties and leading up to the Great Depression. Then, as you write, things fall apart. What happens?
Right. Well, the war ended, and the response of most people, most of the political and economic and social leaders of the developed world was, this was a terrible war. It was a terrible thing. It is now time to restore what we had before. The global economy before 1914 worked very well, had some problems, but it worked very well. Let's put it back together. And they tried for 20 years to put it back together, and they never succeeded. And not for lack of trying. There was conference after conference, international organization after international, treaty after treaty, government commitment after government commitment, and nothing worked. It wasn't because the technological advances of the pre-1914 era stopped. In fact, the interwar period saw some of the most amazing technological advances in modern history. The rise of mass consumption and mass production, the automobile, the refrigerator, the airplane, all of those things. The technological advances were stunning in this period. It wasn't even because the economy stopped growing, because during the 1920s, as you said, economies did grow pretty rapidly. In fact, the 1920s have the distinction of, many countries having a unique name. They're called the Roaring Twenties in the U.S., the Baldwin Age or the Jazz Age in the United Kingdom, the Weimar Republic in Germany, the Dance of the Millions in Latin America. This was a period of very rapid growth. But it was not a period, despite rapid growth, despite major technological advances, despite a lot of efforts, it was not a period in which the world political system was able, or political systems were able to organize themselves to guarantee a continuation of a globally integrated economy. And that was seen in spades when the Depression hit. When the Depression hit, everything fell apart. And the very loose, temporary attempts to restore the pre-1914 globalized world order demonstrated that they were shallow and could not hold together. And the world turned inward in some of the most extreme forms of economic nationalism, and eventually, of course, into war. So what happened in the interwar period was that the pre-existing leaders, or the existing leaders of the advanced industrial countries, attempted over and over again to restore the classical integrated world economy that they had known for generations, and they failed. And that failure unquestionably contributed to the depth and breadth of the Great Depression and to its political and geopolitical consequences.
Professor Frieden, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.